The big stories of the week involve, well, now two horrific plane crashes. One last night, an air ambulance flight that crashed outside of Philadelphia. And then, of course, the big one on Wednesday was the commercial jet crashing with a Black Hawk helicopter near Reagan National Airport. Just incredibly sad sights to see and chat about. But, of course, there's the legal side of that, and that's what we do here on this show. And when you chat about stuff like this, Bob Clifford is often the person we go to simply because he knows a lot about litigation involving these big situations. Bob Clifford, as always, appreciate you joining us. I know it's under tough circumstances, and we appreciate your time.
Well, good afternoon to you, and thank you for having me on the show. You know, no conversation about this can take place without feeling so awful and empathetic to those families. This is a preventable crash that never happened, ever.
Yeah,
ever.
And before we get into the specifics of it and the litigation questions I have about it, I just do want to take a moment, especially for those that are on their way to the airport or something. Air travel is so incredibly safe, and it remains that way even after this incident. And Bob, just to put a fine point on it, I feel like growing up, you know, air travel has always been safe, but you'd hear about crashes on American soil every year or so until really the last decade or two decades, Bob. I mean, this is the first major crash since the Colgan flight.
Just to be very clear, I think it's absolutely safe to be flying. If my family was flying today, I would feel very comfortable with it if I was flying today. But the thing about air travel is that it's so definitive, and meaning that, you know, if we get in a car crash, okay, we survive, those things happen. But the problem with aviation, of course, is the forces involved, and the survivability is pretty low in most circumstances. But air travel is absolutely safe. It's been 16 years since we've had a commercial crash on U.S. soil. The other cases have been international. I'm starting the Boeing MAX 8 Ethiopian trial in April in federal court here. But, you know, that happened 6 years ago. It's coming on March 10th. But it's very safe to fly. Very safe.
The incident on Wednesday, totally preventable. I don't think anyone would argue with that when you have something so glaringly, something catastrophic happen. But in many of these cases, Bob, including probably this one, there's a lot of things that lead up to a crash. It takes a lot of things to go wrong before you see a crash like that, which I imagine makes it hard to investigate and hard to start litigating.
Well, it does, but, you know, look, you start with the core elements of what caused it. I don't think, you know, President Trump was right when he talked about the helicopter being too high. That airport itself is notorious for being incredibly congested, and there's been calls in the past for eliminating the helicopter traffic, military traffic in that space. It's restricted space because it's over our nation's capital, so there's not a lot of room to negotiate, you know, the air travel lanes there. We're calling for, I've suggested very quickly that they cease helicopter activity right now until they analyze this thing in full. And what we're learning, it's a communication issue. Yes, the helicopter was too high from everything we know thus far, but it's also true that there are avoidance techniques that we'll be looking at very closely with respect to the airline itself, who, from what we know, was just on a normal flight pattern landing. But that's not that pilot didn't have responsibilities. Those have to be looked at. And that's why it's so essential to gather the black boxes, to analyze the cockpit voice recorders, the digital flight data recorders, to know exactly what was going on and what they could or could not see.
Bob, do we start litigation before we get full reports from the FAA and from the NTSB? What's the order of operations here?
Yeah, I would fully expect that some families will initiate litigation pretty quickly. You know, the NTSB is in charge of the investigation. They get very, very granular, as they should. But in the bigger picture of the litigation itself, I mean, look, I have no hesitancy. I've been contacted by clients. I've yet to be retained. The families are still talking, obviously, and mourning their losses. But they will eventually retain counsel. And someone's going to file a lawsuit. And that's appropriate because you want to have a voice in the process. You know, one of the things that we have fought so hard for in the Boeing litigation is giving the families a voice. They don't even allow the families to participate in the investigation. They don't give them a representative. We have had a terrible time with the NTSB and the FAA fighting for family rights so that at least you know what's happening with the investigation and you can have your own experts participate. And so those are the things that you can initiate once the litigation is going. You can, you know, you've got a voice in the process, and that's what they're going to want.
Bob, is there a strength in numbers with this sort of stuff? Because obviously you have dozens of victims and family members reaching into the hundreds. Do as many of them try and pool under the same counsel as possible to strengthen a case?
Well, they do that. So for an example, in the Ethiopian crash, there were 157 souls lost in that crash. 140 of them filed litigation in Chicago, as the law required the litigation to be against Boeing in Chicago. I directly represent half of those people and also serve as lead counsel for the rest of them. And it's very common for families to retain just a limited number of law firms, but they'll all be consolidated, even if they had 67 different lawyers, which won't be the case. But theoretically, all of those cases will be consolidated. That's the word. It's not a class action, but they're consolidated actions because why the crash occurred is common to everyone. But what is different would be our own individual unique damages. And that's why the court will separate them out that way. But they will put them together and make them work on a consolidated basis to protect the rights of the families in the litigation. That's how that will get organized.
Who is the defendant? I know we don't know yet for this case, but you mentioned Boeing is going to be entering court this year for the 737 MAX situation, the two crashes that happened. We were talking about one of them. But often, is there multiple defendants? I mean, like, is it the maker of the plane, the airline, et cetera?
It will be, well, Bombardier is the maker of that plane. American Airlines and PSA will be a local operator. A lot will depend upon some of the very discrete issues. You've got air traffic control issues. Now, remember, air traffic control and the Army helicopter pilots, those are a government, and therefore, number one, federal court will be required for claims against all of them. And number two, the jury is only a participation of force in the case of the American and Bombardier and the local operator. Any claims against the air traffic controllers, the FAA, or the military are federal claims handled by the judge. They're put together in front of one courtroom. The jury will listen to all of the evidence if there were ever to be a trial, but the jury's opinion is only advisory to the federal judge as it relates to the air traffic control and the military, and it's decisive as to any of the commercial entities such as American Airlines. What will happen, too, is the courts will force all the parties to mediate and to see if they can resolve and negotiate their differences. And typically when that happens, there's a pooling of energy of the resources. So you'll have the airlines and the insurance companies and the government through the Department of Justice. They will try to create a fund from which the negotiations can come out of that fund, and then possibly they'll have their own separate mediation to decide their own percentages of responsibility. I've seen that occur in the past as well, and I could see something like that happening here.
So if there's multiple defendants, the defendants themselves try and come together and create one united settlement with all the victims at once, as opposed to everyone being litigated individually?
They will try to do that. I mean, all the cases theoretically are, you know, individual, but along the path of litigation, you know, like you go back to the Boeing thing, here we are approaching the 6-year anniversary. Over 100 of the 140 cases that were originally filed are settled. There are about 40 or less than 40 left. Negotiations remain ongoing in all of these cases. That's commonplace. But if they don't resolve by settlement individually, then they're will be a jury trial, as we will have on April 7 in Chicago on the Boeing case.
Chatting with Bob Clifford here, by the way, just to reset things for the audience after a tragic week in the aviation world. Bob, you mentioned that little wrinkle with the federal government, federal cases against, if there is a case against the FAA, perhaps for air traffic control towers or the Army for the Black Hawk helicopters. It's my understanding, too, that the federal government doesn't pay out punitive damages. Is that true?
That is true. And, you know, in aviation litigation, it gets very complicated about what law controls. So, for an example, in wrongful death cases in Illinois, we do have punitive damages now. That's the law. But Illinois law may not control. Under the law of, you know, you have families. We don't know where everyone is from on this this crash, right? We know that there are obviously U.S. citizens. We know there are Canadian citizens. I'm aware of Chinese and Russian citizens, European as well. Well, there will be issues, legal issues, about what damage law controls any individual claim. And it will, the springboard from that will be, well, what punitive damages also apply. And there the court will look at defendants themselves as to where they're headquartered, where their conduct occurred that gave rise to this. You know, I'll tell you a very interesting issue here right now. What law applies to a crash where the actual fuselages end up in a river, a navigable water? Are there maritime law issues here? We're looking at those things. And where exactly in the river did it fall? Is it a dividing line between
Virginia?
States?
Yeah.
It's very complicated. You know, it gets very granular, but that's what, you know, we do to negotiate the rule of law in our country on these kind of claims.
When I was mentioning the order of operations in terms of lawsuits will likely be filed before the NTSB releases its report, does the NTSB report then, if it ends up going to trial or as part of settlement, do you use that to try and show, like, hey, look, we have strong evidence here? Or are you guys litigating this with your own investigators and your own way of doing things?
It's actually both. Under federal law, let me go back to the NTSB. They've already announced that they said that they're going to have a preliminary report within 30 days. You know, that's great. But the fact of the matter is that they could take more than a year for the final report. Mm-hmm. And the NTSB sometimes takes a very long time. Obviously, here there's a lot of attention on this. There's going to be a lot of pressure to get the job done, and that may happen. But in the normal course of the events, the NTSB can be pretty slow, and I hope they aren't here. But under the rules of court, only the factual conclusions, observations, and investigation that the NTSB finds are admissible. Their report itself is not admissible, which is why we retain our own experts who will analyze the same data and reach conclusions about piloting experts you'll have. You'll have communication experts. You'll have experts with regard to what kind of equipment was on the aircraft to help identify traffic that might in proximity to you. There's going to be a big dispute, as we're already hearing, about the sufficiency of the operations in the local tower. One operator ATC guy versus two. And we have to retain individual experts who cover all of those issues. You just can't take the NTSB report and say, okay, this is my case, and let's just rely on it. And frankly, sometimes the NTSB, we don't necessarily agree with their conclusions.
Right.
Their goal is to determine probable cause, but sometimes they get very esoteric about it. Instead of being and speaking in plain language about, you had a helicopter that was outside of its permissible altitude, they'll talk about an excursion into unauthorized airspace. Hello, what's that mean?
Yeah, right. Trust me, as someone who has read, I think, nearly every NTSB report that's ever existed, sometimes right before I get on a flight, which is always the worst time to read one of those.
Oh, that's real good.
Oh, I know. I'm my own worst enemy when it comes to my nerves about flying. Although I do appreciate when I read the reports, first of all, again, how many things usually have to go wrong in order for something like this to happen. But also, I've read plenty of NTSB reports on planes that have landed successfully after some harrowing, amazingly difficult scenarios in which the airplane was still able to get to the ground. They don't make as much news, Bob, but those are often just harrowing stories of pilots and the machines doing exactly what they're supposed to do.
Well, we only recognize the failures, right? We applaud failure and ignore success sometimes, and that certainly can happen in aviation. But that's part of the problem. I mean, when you have these cutbacks, the notion of the near misses, and it's coming out now, you're seeing more widely reported that there are an awful lot more of near misses that we just don't know about.
Oh, yeah.
But that's why, again, I still emphasize that when you have professionals at work who are properly trained, who are vigilant in their jobs, aviation travel is going to be, safe and safely executed. And, you're going to get home to your family and loved ones.
When you get one of these cases and you start, figuring out and have investigators looking at it, are you looking for like a percentage of blame? This is such a crude way to looking at it, but I guess it's how we do it. Like, for example, let's say 40% we're going to blame the training on the helicopter, 40% on the air traffic controller, and 20% on the plane.
It doesn't work that way.
Okay.
It doesn't really work that way. I mean, if we were retained today, our focus would be on helping the family navigate the challenges. I mean, listen, there is nothing worse than counseling a family who has lost a loved one under these circumstances, particularly right now, those families where the bodies haven't been recovered. Okay,
right.
I can tell you that will haunt these families. In the Ethiopian crash, there were people that they got nothing back, or they got a small piece of DNA back, or they got it back on multiple occasions. So, three funerals in one instance. So our job is to work with the family to try to educate them about the process, to assure them that their legal rights are being protected. And then me and our staff, we go about the task of gathering their personal evidence so that we can present the damage claim to talk about who the decedent was and who the family is and what the tragedy is that survives this senseless loss. And then, so that's on one track. And then you have the other track of the expert witnesses that you hire and that try to observe the investigation and do as much as they can individually. But go back to the fact that the NTSB is in charge here. And that's one of the criticisms of the NTSB process. The families don't have a voice. The families don't have rights.
Right.
And we have fought the NTSB about that. Historically, and it was out of the Boeing crashes where we got a greater voice, and the families are recognized as victims. And so the whole idea is that we do as much as we can on outside of that official investigation to gather the technical information we know. I mean,
I hate to interrupt you, but I got to hit a news break. Bob, can I keep you for a few extra minutes? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, sure.
All right, that'd be great. Okay, that's Bob Clifford. I got some follow-up questions for him. He's the kind of go-to guy. It's John Hanson here on a Saturday afternoon. It's Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. If you're wondering, what show is this? Yeah, we're normally on from 1 to 3, but we got bumped back because of Blackhawks hockey, so we'll take it till 6 p.m. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. You can call in or text in with questions that you have for our guests today. Our first one here, Bob Clifford, kindly giving us some extra time here on his Saturday late afternoon. He's from Clifford Law Offices, and he has represented those injured or killed in every major commercial airline crash in the U.S. over the last four decades. I know, Bob, you've been chatting with some of the families already, I believe I heard you say, from the crash that happened on Wednesday. I haven't retained counsel of any of them. And I guess I have a personal question for you, Bob, and it's a professional one, too. But how do you navigate these days and weeks when you're chatting with family members who are experiencing the worst moments of their lives and not try and come across like a lawyer wanting to retain their counsel? Do you kind of see what I'm asking here? Because you're obviously a human first.
Well, you are. But, I mean, look, we all have our skill sets, right? And the good Lord has blessed me with the ability to represent people in these terrible circumstances where, the emotions run high. and it gets very challenging, and it's hard to counsel these folks. But you know, we have a rule in my office: the customer and the client is always right. And rule number two: if the customer and client is wrong, you go back to rule number one. I mean, to do this work, you have to have an inexhaustible ability to be compassionate and listen and understand. But they're there for guidance because, you know, these issues are very complicated. While we were on break, I got a report from one of my partners about an analysis that we're doing where the actual crash itself occurred in D.C. The conduct of the air traffic controlled in controllers occurred in Virginia. So where did the activity and detail from the authorized airspace for the helicopter, that might have also been Virginia. I mean, this is going to be a very complicated case. And your mission is to stay on focus and tasked to get the job done and help people understand the process. Because no one knows this process, and you don't want to know this process. It's a god-awful process. I hope I'm answering your question.
You are. I think that some people may listen, and, you know, there's a lot of criticism about how litigious of a society we are, but damages in the form of money is the only thing we have, right? Like, I mean...
Well, and that's right. And frankly, one of the criticisms that I made today, or this week, rather, and make today, you know, you hear the head of the American Airlines. He gets on TV, and he talks about all the compassion that he has for the family. And I frankly believe him. I hope they do. But that is not always the case, okay? That's number one. And the families from the Ethiopian crash and the Lion Air crash, they fought for that. Because what happens at the end of it, once the business people do their thing on TV, then you get the insurance people who play hardball with the lawyers in the litigation, and we have to fight them about everything. And that's what happens in these cases. It's the nature of it. So there's like pandering to the public, and it's our job to fight that. And we do it on behalf of our clients. We try to keep our clients away from that because it will really distress them even all the more. The families have to fight for their rights here. Otherwise, when all is said and done, the insurance people and the business people are going to want to save money, and they're going to save money at the expense of the families who are the ones who really suffered the losses.
Yeah. You're the person to ask for this exact question because you represented, I believe, some of the folks in the Colgan Air Flight crash, which was in 2009, which was the last major crash from a U.S. airline we had. I had never heard of PSA Airlines. I know they are a subsidiary of American Airlines. How does that complicate things? Because I had never heard of Colgan Air before that crash.
They're a local operator. They're all covered under the same. Believe it or not, there is one insurance policy on every single commercial airplane that's in the sky right now that is covering each one of those commercial flights with insurance coverage of about $2.5 billion. And that's whether it's the local operator or it's the major airline itself that's the big sponsor. And that's because of the phenomenon of reinsurance. Because statistically, the idea that globally two events are going to occur at one moment in time and get covered by the same policy is so so small. The fact that there's a local operator like PSA in this instance is not a problem at all. The families will not be in a position where the biggest complication here is the intersection between federal, ATC, the military, and that commercial airline. That's going to be the complex problem to navigate because they're just different laws that apply to claims against the federal government that apply to claims against an airline.
Yeah. And obviously each crash is so different. The Ethiopia one and the 737 MAX 8, we don't have to relitigate that whole thing. I know you're about to do it yourself, but the redesign of the engines, which then made them kind of retrofit them on, fit them on a plane that really wasn't designed for an engine that size.
Well,
I know I'm simplifying it, Bob, but...
Yeah, it was more of a soft... Well, you're right, but when it got more granular, it was really the software that would allow that disharmony between the sides of the engines and the wing fit and work, and that ultimately became a software problem. But
that case is going to trial, you said, Bob, this spring.
Yeah, we're starting trial's on April 7. What the judge there is, Judge Alonzo, has organized it. He's been a terrific judge for us all to work with, and he's organized it in such a way that two families will be able to present their case at one time in front of one jury, and if hypothetically those two cases were to resolve in negotiations, then the next two families will step up, and two families after that. That's the process. And then there's another a trial in July, and then finally there's a trial scheduled in November. And by that time, possibly all the cases or the vast majority of the cases will be resolved. It's going to go on for quite some time. It's just the nature of civil litigation.
Yeah,
and then COVID didn't help us. You know, COVID really helped hurt the process.
Right, because that's going to be nearly 6 years by the time this thing gets.
It'll be 6 years on March 10 of 2025.
Wow.
Imagine that.
So how does, I want to make sure I understand this, and sorry for getting in the weeds, but this is the legal show, so we got the time for it.
Sure.
You're litigating with two families. Is the goal to settle and then that gets applied to all the families then again?
No. These are, once again, we'll go back to what I said before. Why the crash occurred is common to everyone. So we've already litigated that. And in all the work we did, Boeing finally admitted responsibility. Okay, that is the agreement. They finally come in and said, yes, we're responsible for the crash. Now we will turn to the individual damages of each family. So each trial that's coming up is the trial, the loss for each family. So, for an example, one case is a gentleman from Italy, survived by a wife and two lovely children. The next case is the case of a widow who is the only survivor of her husband, a young couple that was married. Then you have another, and that one is from Canada. Then you have a family from France where it's a wife survived with three small babies, and then you have an American citizen survived by a wife and a big family, and each one of those cases will be analyzed by the jury, or there will be ongoing negotiations between the lawyers for each of those families and Boeing and the insurance representatives of Boeing, and that's how the case will get resolved.
Wow.
It's either a jury's going to decide how much the families are entitled to, or the families will reach an agreement directly with the insurance companies.
Bob, how big is your team? I mean, this is...
We've had a lot of people.
Yeah. How do you do that?
Yeah, well, at any given time, when the case first started, there were over 40 law firms. And I assembled a team of lawyers that did most of the workup of the case. And probably at any given time, we had 20 lawyers doing depositions and all sorts of other things. So traveling... We've traveled all over the world with the families. We spent a lot of time in Seattle taking depositions of the Boeing engineers. We've got expert witnesses from all over the world. We've been taking depositions. You know, the tough duty for me, this summer I spent taking a bunch of depositions in Rome to preserve evidence to present to the jury. London, pick a country. Those families came from 35 different countries around the world.
I mean, it's just mammoth, these cases. And obviously, you and your firm, you bear the brunt of the costs until you get a ruling, right?
Yeah, that's the typical model is that the lawyers advance the expenses of the litigation, and that's what's happened here. And then you're entitled to be reimbursed for that out of the settlement recovery.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
We've had a couple of great questions on the text line, just talking about how granular an investigation can get. I know you can't necessarily know exactly what happened in this specific case, but the six Riosas, just hypothetically speaking, what happens if we determine that maybe the night vision goggles that were used by the helicopter pilots were faulty in what they were able to show in a scope? I mean, could you go after the manufacturer of goggles?
Let's assume that were to be true. If that is a fact that comes out into the evidence, then theoretically that manufacturer could be sued. However, the Army will be accountable for that no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
The Army might then turn around and they might sue the manufacturer of those goggles, right?
Wow.
So that's how something like that, you know, so you can have a claim over.
Yeah, I think it's hard to comprehend how big these cases really can be. And at the end of the day, again, you're seeking compensation for people who are living through the worst moments of their lives. I mean, it's not a perfect system, Bob, but it's what we got.
It is not a perfect system. Well, very interesting. You know, this is a whole subject unto itself. But if you look at the global society, because, again, in the Boeing case, 35 nations, right? So we've looked at the laws of the around the world, and almost to a one, every nation has some kind of law where we compensate families for these non-economic losses, society, the loss of society and the grief and the sorrow, the pain that goes with the loss of your loved one. We compensate them somehow. In some nations, you might compensate them with a couple of animals. You might compensate someone by punishment of a senior member of the company that caused the harm.
Right.
Go into some of the Muslim countries. Theoretically, you get physical harm as the punishment. I mean, but the point being, we compensate. And under the laws of the United States, our rule of law is that we substitute money damages. And there are money damages. I mean, when you're talking loss of the person who is the breadwinner in a family, you see the economic disaster that can occur to some of these people. They can't pay their bills. But it's emotional pain that, the fact that you never get your loved one back because the plane hit the ground at 600 miles an hour, creating a crater 35 foot deep and 2 football fields wide, and you never get your loved one back. None of the personal effects come back. These are things that haunt these people, and it's re-triggered every year that there's an anniversary of it. Or in the case of Boeing, when more and more information is disclosed about their wrongful conduct. It's been a terrible experience for all of these things. I've never seen anything like it. It's a remarkable case.
Bob, keep us posted on that case. I'd love to chat with you as it progresses along through. And obviously what's happening here this week, obviously you don't know yet if you'll retain counsel from any of the family members. But if you do, be sure to let us know. I'd love to follow up more on this. And in the ultimate goal of just helping us all understand how this works and the ultimate goal of trying to provide something for families that are going through just the worst of it this week.
Happy to keep you abreast of what's happening.
Yeah, Bob, I appreciate your extra time here today. Thank you so much for your expertise.
You're very welcome. Have a good evening. Good weekend to all.
Yeah, you too. That's Bye. Bob Clifford of Clifford Law, cliffordlaw.com.